Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad.
It may be a bit astonishing to WGTD listeners who think of me more as a classical person and opera in particular, but the very first record album I bought with my own money was The Supremes' I Hear a Symphony. And for many, many years, I was a devoted fan of this group and still am fascinated by their story, by their allure, and by whatever went wrong that ultimately led to the breakup of the group, which came to be known as Diana Ross and the Supremes. And that story is told with great thoroughness and care for detail in a new book called The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, and Betrayal, published by Da Capo. And the author is Mark Hrabowski, who has written a number of different books. Perhaps you've heard of He's a Rebel, Phil Spector, rock and roll's legendary producer, also a very highly regarded book about Satchel Paige, also a complete history of the Negro Leagues, and this really interesting book, which I have thoroughly enjoyed reading. And I went into this knowing a lot about the Supremes, but came away learning a whole lot. And so we will listen to a few excerpts from some of the biggest hits of the Supremes, maybe one or two songs that will be a little less well-known. And most importantly, we will talk with Mark Hrabowski about his experience of writing the story of one of the biggest phenomenons in music history. I mean, scoring more number one hits than anyone except for Elvis Presley and the Beatles. Mark Hrabowski, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Maybe we could just start out with a couple of kind of general questions before we dig into some of the specifics of this complex story. Can you tell us about your own personal encounter with the music of the Supremes? At some point, did you become fans of them? And as a fan, were you writing this book?
You know, the funny thing is, I didn't think I was. You know, I grew up in that era. I was a teenager. Young, actually, about 10 years old when they, you know, started becoming really popular. I don't know if it was cool for teenage boys to be Supremes fans then. It was almost like a secret pleasure, you know what I mean? There was something about it that, you know, we couldn't admit to it, but we'd always listen to it. And I think through the years, I started admitting to myself that, you know, I really love these. I really love the Supremes. Yeah, that's something you would say in the company of, you know, in the locker room or something like that.
Right.
But it's true because I think there's something about, you know, you mentioned opera before. It's operatic. It's, you know, there are numerous musical influences that went into it. It's the genius of Berry Gordy and the genius of Holland Dozier Holland, the genius of Diana Ross and her getting how those songs could only have been sung to become popular the way they were. And I just think that through the years, this congealing, you know, it dawned on me that, you know, 12 number one hits, and not only that 12 number one hits, because Mariah Carey now has 12 number one hits, and I don't think anybody would place her on the same pedestal. The fact that they had 12 number one hits from 61 to 70, now consider what changes were going on in music during those years. That was like the pop idol era to the Beatles era to the heavy Beatles era to the Stax Volt, you know, quote-unquote, real R&B, you know, real black music kind of era, to Woodstock, to Altamont, and through all that time, the Supremes were having number one hits. At a time when the girl group sound, per se, was thought to be dead. Now, there has to be something very, very special about that. It can't be luck. It can't be a fluke. It can't be that they hit on some formula, you know, that was good for a couple of years of hits. This is, we're talking about an 8-9 years of ineffable success, you know. These and were not only number one hits. These were hits that dominated the charts.
And not only that, of course, but we're also talking about black artists who were incredibly popular across a wide swath of the American public. I mean, including white guys like you and me. And there were a lot of people with us who were really enchanted with the Supremes. And, I mean, in a sense, this was the kind of breakthrough that was really uncommon, all but unheard of at that moment in time.
And the funny thing is, it was something that Gordy envisioned even from the late 50s. But he needed a muse. He needed a vehicle to be able to do it. And it didn't happen until the Supremes, and I don't think it would have happened. You know, when you look back at Motown, there are songs by other groups like Nowhere to Run or Dancing in the Streets or Money by Barrett Strong, songs that really were better than any Supreme song, more stood the test of time better. But nobody ever had a consistent run, where the excellence just kept coming one after another after another after another. And it's true that more than any other Motown group, they did make that transition. It was called crossover. You know, that was the great dream of all black musicians and record company executives to cross over into the white market and sell just as many there, if not more, than in the black community. And that didn't happen until the Supremes. And if you listen to that track you had before, Back in My Arms Again, you know why. If you dissect that, as you could dissect any other Supremes track, you know why. The mystery is in there. Because, you know, I'm not going to go into the technicalities, but I did interview the Holland brothers, Brian and Eddie Holland, two-thirds of the producing songwriting team, Holland Dozier Holland, which was responsible for 10 of the 12 number one Supremes hits. But, you know, I sat for hours talking to these guys about the chassis of each of these songs. And it is true, it was done in a very meticulous, almost mad scientist way, in a way that would be amenable to the white market. Like, the beat was called 4x4, that was the drum beat that you heard, which was the drum striking on every beat, like bang, 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 instead of every other beat, which is the way it was usually done for R&B records, because as it was explained to me, white audiences would clap on that 4x4 beat. They would clap on that bang, 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 bang. Whereas black audiences would clap on the clap, clap. You know what I'm saying?
Right. On just the backbeat, as opposed to...
Just on the backbeat. There was a difference in the way black and white audiences heard and reacted to music. So when you listen to Back of My Arms Again, for example, you would hear that Benny Benjamin, that was the great drummer, legendary drummer of Motown, just nailing in the pocket that 4x4 beat. And that was practically on every single Supremes record until later on, when Reflections, you know, that era started coming about, Love Child, when they started changing the thematic content as well as how the music sounded. But this was how it was made. It was black music by black musicians called the Funk Brothers in later years. That was the Motown House Band. But playing white music. It was an unbelievable formula, and it could only have worked, I think, with Diana Ross out front with that gossamer kind of voice that you could almost reach through. That's what made it all work.
One of the Holland brothers you quote as saying, We didn't want to be just another bunch of black guys making music as a cause. We didn't want to put all our energies year after year into making music three people would listen to that would never get beyond a black radio station and the jukebox in some dingy blues club on the edge of the docks.
Right.
I mean, they were looking at something a whole lot bigger than that, and of course managed to achieve it.
And they were groomed in that respect by Gordy. They were just kids. This is another of the secrets of Motown. Gordy would comb through the community, not for veteran R&B guys, but for young guys who didn't have that you know, we've got to do this R&B thing here. We've got to go out to the clubs and do it. He wanted people who would just make hits, you know, come in and whether they were drawing country influence, you know, or operatic influence, as with I Hear a Symphony, or anything that would produce a hit record. He wanted that in the back of their minds. And that was one of the key successes of Motown.
Hmm. We're speaking with Mark Hrabowski. We're talking about his book, The Supremes. I want to ask you just a couple other kind of general questions, and then we'll dig into this fantastic story. I'm wondering how you went about not only telling this story, but sort of going about trying to untangle so many of the knots which have come about over the years. I mean, because there is also wrapped up in this story not only great success, but also intense unhappiness and resentment and so on, and which in some respects has only grown over the years. And I'm just wondering, first of all, as someone really trying to tell this story as truthfully as possible, as you really clearly are in this book, how do you get past that? I mean, particularly when you have someone at the heart of this story like Diana Ross, who obviously attracted so much antagonism from those who worked closely with her. How do you figure out what is truth and what is just sort of bitterness and sort of the remaking of history to make kind of a nasty person look even more nasty? I don't envy you that task.
That wasn't my intention, by the way. I mean, people have been saying this in reviews and so on. All the reviews have been quite good, but there's always this theme somewhere that it's another negative look at Diana Ross. I didn't set out to do that.
Sure, and just to be clear, I'm not saying that you did that. I'm saying that, you know, for instance, the people you interviewed recalling these events.
That's exactly right.
I wonder, as the author, I mean, I think one of the things you do in your book is you're pretty clear to say, in many cases, stories get embellished over time and things are given this sort of theatrical bent about, you know, the way certain escapades were described or whatever. But I mean, as the author, what led you and guided you in trying to tell this story truthfully and in trying to be fair to everybody involved?
Well, that's exactly what I was trying to do. Yeah, as you say, I mean, the Supremes may be the most written about group other than the Beatles and Elvis in history, but everything that had been written about them was sort of bathed in this celebrity pseudo-journalism, you know, this tabloid-style gossip where the music was basically an afterthought and everything was geared around Diana Ross and her divahood and all that kind of stuff. It's a very difficult job, not the least because Diana Ross and Mary Wilson themselves don't seem to even remember much of what happened back then. I don't know if it's a case of trying to push it out of their minds or whatever. I mean, Mary has said she actually, when she wrote Dream Girl, her autobiography in the early 80s, that she had to go to see therapists for months just to be able to remember some of this stuff. I could only imagine if Flo Ballard had lived, what she would have had to do to recall some of the stuff, because she was thrown out like yesterday's trash by Motown. It was the shame of Motown, and it killed her, basically, on a figurative level. So, you know, there's a lot of pain involved, but that doesn't excuse why Diana Ross has such a superficial memory of what happened. She's of no use at all to a biographer. And she's had several books published which were failures, I'm very happy to say. But even Mary Wilson's took great liberties with the truth. So I almost had to be a detective in this and running down the threads, you know, and corroborating, you know, with other people how it happened. I could only hope I got most of it right, because the Supremes, as you say, you know, everybody has an opinion on them. I mean, everybody, there's no neutral opinion about the Supremes. I talked to some of the other women of Motown and the girls in Martha and the Vandellas and the Marvelettes, who hate Diana Ross and every day hate her more. You know, it's like mellowed like fine wine, their hatred of Diana Ross. Because she was so obnoxious. And she was so unkind to them. That's why when people say, you know, oh, it's another Diana rip job, you can't help but be negative about Diana Ross, because she made herself negative with her, you know, parading around the fact that she was having affairs with married men like Smokey Robinson and Brian Holland, and later on Berry Gordy. Although he wasn't married, he was 15 years older. I mean, she would parade this around. She would be so obnoxious about it. But as you say, I did try to be even-handed. I got stories about Diana Ross's generosity that people may not have heard before, how she did try to help Flo Ballard through the years, how she did provide a trust fund for Flo's children, how she, you know, just through the years displayed wonderful acts of kindness. So Janie Bradford, who was co-writer of Money at Motown, Berry Gordy's secretary, later on hit the skids and was having some very difficult time in the 80s and 90s. And she appealed to Diana, who put one of her songs on the flip side of one of her big hits, which made her a fortune. So there are acts of kindness that Diana Ross has done, which, you know, do tend to balance out the picture a little bit, but you cannot run away from the fact that Diana was Diana. She was as bad as she wanted to be. And you're not being a celebrity journalist, pseudo-journalist, by mentioning it, but you do have to balance it out.
Did you make an attempt to speak directly with, for instance, Diana Ross or Mary Wilson or Cindy Birdsong, the woman who ultimately replaced Florence Ballard? I mean, was it even worth the attempt to try to speak with them directly?
No, I didn't want to. I consciously wanted to avoid that. I didn't want it to make it seem as though I owed anybody anything in exchange for an interview. You know, that I would have to give veto power, and I'd have to show them what their quotes look like. I didn't want it to. I really wanted it to be an independent look. Besides which, as I said, these two have they have selective amnesia when it comes to the Supremes. Everything is sort of geared to make them look better.
Right. And I suppose, let's say Mary Wilson had agreed to speak with you, in a sense that would not have done a lot towards the cause of trying to be fair with the Supremes. Because
yeah, right. Wouldn't you have to get Diana Ross to be fair? If you just get Mary Wilson and not Diana, wouldn't it mean that you're tilting toward Mary? Yeah, so I wanted to avoid those issues. And Cindy Birdsong was basically, you know, there for the, she was given a free ride. She really did. She was never even sang on any of the Supremes records in the 60s. So, you know, she probably wouldn't have offered that much. But, you know, I mean, I wanted to keep it as an outsider getting to the bottom of what made the Supremes tick. And I really don't think having Mary, you know, tell stories that made herself look good at Diana's expense, I really didn't think that would further that cause, you know.
We're speaking with Mark Grabowski. We're talking about his book called The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, and Betrayal. I actually knew very, very little about the beginning of The Supremes. I just had never really taken the time to explore any of this. So this is what was especially helpful to me, learning a lot about where they grew up. Chapter one of your book is called Three Girls from the Projects. One of the things you say in the first paragraph is the only common ground other than their legacy that the three Supremes ever really shared was a 15-block grid of southeastern Detroit, framed by the massive Cadillac plant within the Hamtramck Street Beltway to the north, the Brewster Douglas housing development. You said they scarcely would have even seen each other because these were almost like multiple cities within the that stretch of Detroit, and yet they ultimately do cross paths and ultimately do form this singing group. Just briefly sketch why they were such different people from one another, even from the beginning.
Well, whether they were different or not, the point of it is they really didn't know each other. See, Motown tried to purvey this fable about the Supremes, that they were childhood friends who grew up in the projects and were close as sisters. Couldn't be further from the truth. They did grow up in Brewster, but as you say, that was like a teeming mass of humanity there. And they lived in different sections. One of the problems with Diana was that her family lived in what was considered the upscale section of the projects, because they had a townhouse. You know, they were off to the side, whereas Flo and Mary lived in the tenement buildings that pretty much marked it when you looked at a distance and you saw the Brewster, the smoke coming out of these big tenement houses. But they didn't really know each other. They went to separate schools. They only bisected fleetingly, temporarily, and they didn't. And Flo and Mary didn't even like Diane much because they thought she was snooty from where she came from within the project. So when they actually went for the audition, their first audition with the guy who was putting together the Supremes, who were called the Primettes then, a guy named Milton Jenkins, who was like a pimp, hustler, you know, flashy guy in a red Cadillac. They didn't bring Diane along. They got to his room for the audition, and Diane was sitting there with the fourth member of the Supremes, because there was a foursome at the beginning. It was a girl named Betty McClown, who was Paul Williams' girlfriend, Paul Williams being the later Temptation, who with Eddie Kendricks was in a group called the Primes, which was the brother group of the Primettes put together by Milt Jenkins. His girlfriend, Betty, had brought Diana Ross in. Diane Ross, actually, her name. So Mary and Flo didn't even know she would be there.
So the fiction created by Motown is right, that they were these three high school buddies who dreamt of singing together and auditioned for him, and the rest is history.
And loved each other like sisters, which, you know, later on, they were anything but sisterly.
In the early going, I mean, in the very, very, very early going, the strongest leader of these women was Florence Ballard, and she also seemed to be by far the most powerful singer and the one that took most of the leads. Now, this is before they're even making any recordings or anything. And apparently this Milton Jenkins, who actually kind of drew them together for the first time, one of the things he contributes to this is he suggests Diana Ross sing lead on some of the songs that they were doing, which is an interesting precursor of what's to come.
Yeah, we have to thank Milton Jenkins for that. Actually, they all three sang lead. They were alternate, but Flo was generally regarded as the leader of the group. She was the most aggressive. She would talk for them, because Diane was very shy as a teenager, and Mary was as Mary always would be, the cipher, the one who didn't say much, just wanted to, you know, be there, didn't want to rock the boat. Flo is the one who took the lead in, you know, dealing with club owners and promoters and so on and so forth. And she had that big, booming voice.
I love what Otis Williams says. Now, he's one of the, you know, am I remembering, he's one of the Temptations?
Oh, yeah, he's the sole surviving one.
Right. You quote him at one point saying, Flo would just sing and blow the doors off.
Yeah.
And he goes on to say that was why she never could accept Diane's emergence, because she didn't understand it, that it's more than who can sing better. And that statement suggests that at least in the early going, the woman who was really the strongest singer was Florence Ballard.
She was, but she wasn't a commercial. She didn't have a commercial voice. She would just like to get up on stage and belt it out, which would be great at a Friday night church talent show or something like that. But Motown was in the business of selling records, and selling records to hopefully to white record buyers. And it was true that Diane, even as a teenager, as Milton Jenkins could perceive, had that voice that would appeal to, you know, the entire spectrum of record buyers. She had that gossamer, soft, little girlish kind of voice, but could be very powerful and very emotional. She's very, I give Diana Ross all the credit. as a performer, she's absolutely brilliant. There never would have been any success to the Supremes with a different lead singer. There's just no way it could have happened. She actualized the Holland Dozier Holland formula better than even Eddie Holland thought was possible. He said, you know, what we had in Diana Ross is something that comes along, you know, once in a million years, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's true that Gordy, as a businessman, as a hard-headed businessman and, you know, music man, was able to see and hear that she was the one who would have to lead the Supremes. The only problem was, in doing so, she treated Flo, he treated Flo, and also Diane later on treated Flo like, basically like trash being thrown out to the curb. Hmm. And that was the problem. On a human level, Berry Gordy had absolutely no understanding of how to treat people.
Hmm.
I mean, he didn't treat them very well as far as paying them to begin with.
Right.
But he treated them like interchangeable parts. And what he did to Flo Ballard, I consider the shame of Motown.
Hmm.
I really do.
And, of course, it's especially sad given that in many respects, the kernel of this idea of let's start a singing group, if that idea was any of these women's, it was Florence Ballard's when she found Mary Wilson and this and that, and then ultimately they run into Mr. Jenkins, who already knows Diana Ross. But I mean, if there was a moving force and if anyone had these dreams in the very early days, it was Florence Ballard, which makes it even sadder that ultimately she found herself torn away from all this when the group was at the height of its success.
And also, not only being removed as the lead vocalist, but the only song they allowed her to have a solo on, which was People, the Barbra Streisand song, People, that was in their act for years. And the fans loved it, because that was when Flo really was turned loose. She could really belt it out. When they were at the Copacabana, a signal moment in their history, in Motown history, in 65, in the summer of 65, they took that song away from Flo. They gave it to Diane. I mean, it was almost as if Gordy was trying to taunt Flo into quitting the group or making a scene that would allow him to fire her. Because as early as 65, he didn't want Flo in the group. He didn't think Flo fit the picture, the image of the three princesses, the Cinderella fable that he was weaving around the Supremes. He wanted Flo out.
Hmm.
But he just didn't know. How do you do that with someone in a group that has five consecutive number one hits right off the bat? You can't really do that.
Of course, as we tell this story, we're not quite at consecutive hits yet. In the early going, when they have first finally signed with this new company called Motown and Berry Gordy, after their second audition, in the early going, Berry Gordy does not seem to know exactly what to do with these women. And it's really interesting to listen to some of the first recordings made by the Supremes. I mean, there's even one or two, I guess, with when they were still a foursome.
Right.
But even the first recordings of the three of them, it's not at all the sound of that we're going to hear just a couple years later. The one I have handy that I thought we'd just listen to for a minute or two is one of their early recordings called Buttered Popcorn. Do you want to say anything to introduce this, aside from what I've just said?
It was one of the big, major flops in Motown history, and written and produced by none other than Berry Gordy. See, the problem was they didn't know how to handle girl groups, because the girl group genre was still basically unformed at that time. It was before the Shirelles really took, and the Ronettes and the Crystals came about. So Smokey Robinson and Berry Gordy, none of them knew how to write girl group kind of material, and it shows in Buttered Popcorn, which was a cop on the Shirelles and was an absolute disaster.
I believe you tell us Flo Ballard is actually the lead on this.
It was her one and only lead vocal on any Supreme single.
Hmm. Here's just a little bit of it.
To the show. He said he wanted some more.
I mean, even a devoted Supremes fan would probably never guess that that's the Supremes we're listening to. I mean, It is so different from the sound that would make them famous. Could you, for a moment, contrast the Supremes with other girl groups, which, I mean, the Supremes were the first to sign with Motown, I believe, if I remember correctly.
The Marvelettes actually snuck in there. The Supremes came early and were told, they were still in high school and were told by Gordy to finish school and to come back. He actually just was trying to get rid of them, and they came back. But I think before they signed, the Marvelettes had actually snuck in there. But, yeah, they very, very close. I mean, yeah.
But it was the Supremes sort of felt like they were first and always felt like they should have been the ones to score the first big hit. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. They struggled while, for instance, the Marvelettes overtook them rather easily. And other groups at Motown as well, right? I mean, other girl groups.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. They were all above them in the totem pole. Martha and the Vandellas, they all had hits early. I mean, the Marvelettes came in with a hit. They had written Please, Mr. Postman. They came in with that themselves. So once, even though the Supremes, I think they actually did, they were the first, January of 61, who were signed. They were all forgotten about because the Marvelettes then had a number one hit, Motown's first number one hit. Yeah. In fact, when one of the Marvelettes took ill, Flo was called on to replace them. She was a replacement Marvelette at a show at the Apollo Theater, you know, which Diana hated. Mary thought it was fine, you know, because it was the Motown family and everybody was, you know, pitching in for everybody else. But Diane said, listen, we deserve to have the number one hit.
Right.
The first number one hit. We deserve the attention, not them.
And unfortunately, they were being given songs like Buttered Popcorn to sing. By the way, we've skipped over an intriguing little detail. You spoke to a receptionist at Motown at the time, Janie Bradford, who tells us the story of how this group of girls went from being the Primettes to the Supremes.
Yeah, Janie was Gordy's secretary, receptionist, whatever, but she had also written Money, the Barrett Strong, the famous Money, That's What I Want, and she was... she actually had to give the go-ahead for anybody to have an audition back then. She had a lot of power. And the first time she saw the Supremes came in, she said, big deal. You know, they didn't sound any more unique than any of the other hundreds of kid groups that were coming through Motown. But it was Janie who actually named the Supremes. This is another, you talk about weeding through the fables and the myths. Everybody has claimed to have named them, including Flo and Mary and Diane. You know, it wasn't. It was, and actually, Janie didn't do it actively. She put a number of names into a hat, and it was picked out by Flo. And they liked the Supremes. There were others like the Jewelettes, for example, the Royalettes. You know, like that. It's amazing how history, you know, fate guides everything. I don't think the Supremes ever would have, or you know, that group ever would have become what they did had they been the Jewelettes. You know what I mean? Everything had to be perfectly, everything had to be perfectly fated. And I always say that Berry Gordy was the luckiest man in the face of the earth, Lou Gehrig notwithstanding. He was blessed with the timing of luck and the luck of timing. Everything he did turned to gold then, and even the name applies to that formula, you know. Yeah. The Supremes.
The Holland Dozier team eventually is assigned to the Supremes. And I guess one of the reasons why it was so important for them to be given great songs is because of what their particular strengths were compared to some of the other girl groups at the time. I think you were quoting one of the Vandellas, who said, "The Supremes knew their limitations. Their energy was in their voices, their harmonies, their personalities. That was their act." I mean, as opposed to those girl groups who could really dance. I mean, the Supremes could really sing. The problem with that, she goes on to say, is that you need a good, strong song to go with it. I mean, in a sense, some of these other groups, they could get by with songs that were less than fantastic songs. The Supremes couldn't. They had to have musically the very best material, and that's where Hal and Dozier come in.
Yeah, which is why they had failed so miserably. Again, this whole Diana Ross sleeping away to the top thing that everybody always mentions, and I didn't want that to be a crucial focus of the book, but it is in fact true that's what happened. She had affairs very early with two of the most powerful men in Motown. I'm not even talking about Berry Gordy then. I'm talking about Smokey Robinson and Brian Holland, both married men. And because of that, they had the services of Smokey Robinson and later of Brian Holland. And this is really what, as you say, this is really what broke them out at big time, getting Holland, Dozier, Holland to write for them and produce them. That's what they needed, because only those three guys were able to understand how to write a girl group song at that time, having done so with Martha and the Vandellas and the Marvelettes.
Brian said about his brother Eddie, "Every girl group song we did sounded like a young girl wrote it, because Eddie inside the mind of a young girl yearning for love, being protected by a guy, that whole mindset." And then you quote Eddie talking about Brian saying, "I could do that because Brian Holland has the best ears in the world, a very quiet, sensitive man who picks up feelings, vibes all around him." I mean, and that is such a crucial element. I want to play a snippet of "When the Love Light Starts Shining Through His Eyes," which might have been their first huge breakout hit, had something quite unfortunate not occurred, which sort of stopped that song in its tracks. Do you want to tell our listeners about that?
Well, that was actually their first meaningful hit. It went to number 23 in 1963. It was not a prime Holland, Dozier, Holland record. They were basically just showing off, as they kind of describe it. It's a big marching band kind of song, and didn't really use Diana Ross the way they knew they needed to use her. But it was a hit, and yes, it was unfortunately put out on the market at just around the time of the Kennedy assassination, which basically, you know, killed sales for everybody in the business at
right.
the time.
You write, the ongoing shroud of mourning across the country blunted record sales for them. One of the reasons I like this song, my favorite Supreme songs are those where we really hear Mary and Florence and how these substantial voices which they had. I mean, there's nothing sort of faint and pastel. And in some of their other big hits, it is so predominantly Diana Ross that you scarcely even care about the other two. But they play a really meaty role in this particular song. Can we hear just a second of it? Here it is. You know, it's funny, I just realized if you asked me to quote what those lyrics are, I couldn't tell you anything aside from "When the Love Light Starts Shining Through His Eyes."
They didn't mean anything anyway, the lyrics.
So. Well, right around the corner is the Supremes' first big hit, which we'll talk about in just a second. Of course, time is fast moving away from us. I do want you to have a chance to talk briefly about a woman who makes a big difference in the polish of the Supremes, not musically, but in the way they presented themselves. Could you speak a moment about Maxine Powell?
Well, Maxine Powell was imported to me. She was a former fashion model and a an etiquette kind of, you know, finishing school kind of person, you know, and Gordy brought her in. It's funny, he brought her in along with other people like Charlie Atkins, who was a choreographer at the time, to polish up the Motown image on stage. But what he really wanted to do was bring them in to be sort of personal coaches for Diana. The problem is he couldn't have done that without turning off the rest of the stable, obviously. So it became a thing where everybody, all the girl groups, and even some of the guy group acts had to go, you know, to finishing school at Motown, you know, put a book on their head and walk across the floor and everything. What they didn't know was that on the side, Gordy was actually sending Ross off to an actual finishing school for advanced tutelage in that area. Because even in 63, 64, he knew that the long-term plan was that Diana Ross was going to go solo. He really did not care, but he couldn't care less about Mary Wilson and Flo Ballard. He never could. But the problem was he couldn't make any changes because the Supremes were so successful. He couldn't mess with a winning formula like that.
Hmm. You know, one of the things when we untangle that is, you know, the bitterness of Florence Ballard and Mary Wilson. I mean, where I think to at least some extent they really saw themselves as Diana Ross's equals as singing talents, and you kind of wonder under close scrutiny if in fact that really holds true. And from what you've said in this interview already, I think for as much as you have take serious issue with a lot of the ways Diana Ross carried herself off stage, the fact is she was the blazing talent of those three. I mean, there was something very special when it was the three of them together, but she had a talent of another level.
Yeah, I mean, when Shelley Berger was brought in as their manager in 67, and by the way, still Diana Ross's manager to this day, his perspective, you know, he was blunt about it in the book. He said, you know, when I looked at the Supremes, I saw Diana Ross and two backup singers. And that's overstating it, surely. As you say, especially in the early records, the alchemy between the three on the early Holland Dozier Holland records is unmistakable. You hear the balance. You hear the Mary Wilson bottom and the Flo Wilson top in the midst of the background vocals. It was very important. Everything was elemental in those records. Everything had to go perfectly. I don't think they had two other backup singers that would have worked. But later on, it is true. By 67, it was Diana Ross and two backup singers. Literally, there were Flo and then Cindy and Mary. They were not on any of the last Supremes five or six releases in the Diana Ross era. And it didn't matter. Nobody knew it anyway.
Right. I mean, for instance, a song like Love Child.
Love
that's,
Child, yeah.
That's Diana Ross and other singers, even though it was on a record of Diana Ross and the Supremes. And Someday We'll Be Together is also just Diana Ross. You know, it's funny. I remember the day I bought that record album and put on that song. And I remember thinking, wow, who has that chest voice? Is that? I remember looking at the faces of Mary Wilson and Cindy Birdsong on the album cover and thinking, I wonder which of them can sing that low. And of course, it's neither of them. I mean, both the female and male backup vocals of that aren't Mary Wilson or Cindy Birdsong at all.
And you might even be thinking of Johnny Bristol, because he was on that. He was the producer, and Diana was so languid and almost comatose in her vocal that he had to prompt her from the booth. You know, so when you hear on the record somebody saying, you know, sing it, baby, or, you know, you tell them, that was producer Johnny Bristol, you know, because Diana just, she was so bored at the time. And that record, in fact, was like an eight-year-old song that was a hand-me-down twice, never even supposed to be sung by the Supremes. It was supposed to be for Junior Walker and the All-Stars. So you talk about the luck of Berry Gordy. I mean, that's it right there. A song that wasn't even supposed to be becomes their last one in the perfect coda for the group.
Hmm.
Someday we'll be together.
Right. Through the 1960s, as their careers take off, there's a lot of people that make a huge difference. Their big, huge breakout hit, Where Did Our Love Go, came about partly with the help of Dick Clark, or that is,
yes,
in terms of really penetrating into the so-called white market. Dick Clark played a really
Dick
important
Clark,
role.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Dick Clark really was. I mean, he is the unsung hero behind the rise of the Supremes. It was again Gordy pulling rank. You know, the Dick Clark caravan, which was like a summer-long excursion across America with some of the top rock groups in the world, a big bus tour. You know, you had to be pretty good. You usually had to have a hit to get on that, or at least be, you know, have one in the till. You know, but here Gordy again pulls rank, even though the Supremes did not have a major hit at that time and were pretty much obscure. He convinced Dick Clark to take them on the tour, which was quite a thing, you know, unbelievable, because, you know, you think of Martha and the Vandellas and the Marvelettes being shunted aside for that, you know, for Smokey Robinson even, for the Supremes. And it was on that tour that, because of Dick Clark's pitchman qualities, because he would go back to Philadelphia to tape America Bandstand at the time, and he would talk up Where Did Our Love Go. He would put it on the board he had of, impending hits. And he would play it. He would play it on the radio in Philadelphia and, of course, in person out on the tour. And he really, really helped to make that a hit. By the end of the tour, the Supremes had gone from being billed as among the others, quote-unquote, and others, to the headliner of the show. And they didn't even finish out the tour because they had to go and do the Ed Sullivan Show and big gigs like that all of a sudden. Hmm. So Dick Clark definitely gets a lot of the credit for the Supremes.
Well, of course, what follows after that is one blockbuster hit after another. Also, of course, the demise of Florence Ballard. She is ultimately shunted aside. And ultimately, Diana Ross leaves the group altogether. The Supremes limp along a few years after that with relatively tepid success. Your book is also about how really those relationships are never repaired. And ultimately, of course, Florence Ballard herself comes to such a tragic end. Is there anything happy about the way this story ends?
No, as opposed to what we hear and saw in Dreamgirls, which was the Florence character, you know, the Jennifer Hudson, Florence Ballard character coming back and having the last laugh. You know, I mean, anyone who thinks that's the story of the Supremes is woefully misinformed, because Florence Ballard never had the last laugh. She didn't have many laughs in her life to begin with. And it was a horrible tragedy in 1976 when she dies at age 32 of a heart failure, overweight and addicted to alcohol and pills and broken mentally and physically and just a mess. And it's a horrible story. I do give Diana some credit for trying to help Flo out during her declining years. She actually set up a trust fund for Flo's children. She tried to get some money to Flo, although she didn't go through with it because it would have been intercepted by Flo's ne'er-do-well husband, Tommy Chapman, at the time, another guy who dragged her down. Unfortunately, she didn't have enough money to get by. And Mary Wilson never went to her pocketbook once to try to help Flo. She couldn't be bothered, which is why Flo always said she felt more betrayed by Mary Wilson than she did by Diana Ross.
Hmm.
Because Mary would imply and tell her that she would have Flo's back if she needed it, but she was never there for her when push came to shove.
Hmm. That and more in this sad story in this fascinating book called The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, and Betrayal. It's published by Da Capo Press, the author, Mark Hrabowski. Mark Hrabowski, I'm glad we had this conversation. What an interesting book this is. And I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401.